Right now, it's How I Got That Story. As immigration policy tightened after 9/11, more and more detainees were placed into already crowded immigration facilities around the country. 4 years ago, NPR's Daniel Werdling reported on conditions at the Oakdale Federal Detention Center, where immigrant Richard Rust died of a heart attack. The prison's medical staff allegedly took 20 minutes to help him.
Looking at me like, what can we do? I say, yo, what the f***, man, yo. You know, come help the guy. What the f***, you just standing there. You know, come help him. Do what y'all supposed to do.
It seems like they don't care.
The mood was getting very rowdy.
Guys are spitting through the fence. They were kicking over the garbage cans.
They was like shouting, what the f*** taking these people so long to respond?
That was the main question, was where the f*** is the medical staff at when you need them around here? There was none.
Detainees from the Oakdale Federal Detention Center from a Danny Werdling report broadcast in 2004. Things have evidently not improved. In fact, they appear to have gotten worse. On Sunday, the Washington Post began a series of investigative reports that document slipshod procedures, neglect, and mistakes in medical treatment that may have contributed to the deaths of 30 detainees. As part of our occasional series here at the museum, How I Got That Story, Post reporters Dana Priest and Amy Goldstein join us to talk about their series, Careless Detention. We want to hear from you. If you, a friend, a relative, has been held in an immigration detention facility, if you work in one, tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. There's also a conversation underway on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Dana Priest is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. She won this year's Pulitzer Prize for public service. Nice to have you back here at the museum with us.
Thank you.
And Amy Goldstein reports on national social policy for the Post, and good to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
And how did you get this story, Dana?
Can't really talk about that, Neil.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today, and we'll move right along.
But what we can't say is that eventually we got thousands of documents. They're internal documents. They're really something that the volume of which I've never seen in my career, in the sense that they paint this broad and very deep and disturbing view of what's going on inside a little agency within the Immigration Customs Enforcement Office, and that's the medical care. So we have emails and internal reviews, and we have medical autopsies and all sorts of things that help us. We're really the backbone of this story.
And so these are not publicly available documents?
No, they're not, but we've posted some excerpts from them on our website.
And there are other examples. I mean, for example, in part of the series, you tell the story of a Korean-born woman who's been living in this country. And Amy, you say in the piece you interviewed her three times without the knowledge of the officials at the detention center where she was being held. I suspect you're not going to tell me. How did you get that story?
Well, like Dana, I'm going to be a little coy about the details. But what happened was, after we read through and analyzed and tried to create some structure for understanding what all these documents were telling us, we then started to look for people who would illustrate the themes of these written records. And we did this partly by contacting some immigration attorneys, of which there are many in the country, but there are many, many more people who are detained in the federal facilities who are being held with the government's hopes of deporting them eventually. Only 1 in 10 has an attorney inside the system. But this Korean woman, Young Sun Harville, has attorneys. And in the course of talking with them, they mentioned to me that they had a client who was very ill, who was getting very inadequate care, and that's basically how we found her.
Mm-hmm. The documents that you received, they weren't from a Freedom of Information Act inquiry. Would it be fair to say, because several points, there are stricken, conscience-ridden entries, emails and memos from various people at various times, some explaining why they're quitting. Would it be fair to say that this came from whistleblowers, people upset about what's happening?
You know, we just aren't going to go into that. But I do want to talk about what you've just said, because they just don't show the problems. They show the angst within. They show people, you know, tormented over the problems. They show them panicked and afraid that they're going to be sued because they can't give the standard of care that they would like to give. And that's really unusual. It also shows them covering up truths, and that's unusual to get a hold of as well.
Mm-hmm. The system, as you describe it, this Department of DIHS, and it is part of ICE, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security, which
exactly
is still part of the government, last time I looked. But anyway, this agency was set up as essentially a revolving door, that detainees would be placed in it and very shortly thereafter deported. And since 9/11, it's become something a completely different animal. Is that fair to say, Amy?
Well, it's become a couple things at once. I mean, the government will be quick to point out that the average length of stay for people in detention is fairly short. The government uses the figure of 37 days as a pretty recent average. But that average masks widely disparate experiences. Some people come in and out even shorter than that because the government now has a program in which if people are caught illegally right near the Mexican border shortly after they've come into the country, they're deported very, very quickly, usually without even a hearing before an immigration judge. But other people who are contesting their deportations can be in the system for months or even years.
Months or even years, and the fact is a system that is becoming overwhelmed as more and more people come into it. And in fact, in later on in the series, you have apparently state institutions, as in state of Arizona, California, whatever, shaking out people from their mental health institutions into this system, which is completely inadequate to deal
with. And they're not supposed to be doing that. And one of the emails, we didn't actually put it in the paper, but the sentiment was, they're not supposed to be doing this. Who's allowing it to happen and who's calling them on it? And no, there were no answers. One of the problems is you're talking about an agency that doesn't have very much bureaucratic clout within other agencies. So it really is struggling to get the attention of all of its managers on high.
Let's see if we get a caller in on the conversation. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email is talk@npr.org. And this is Frank. Frank with us from Harper County in Kansas.
Hello, I appreciate you putting me on. This is kind of curious because I've been studying the private corrections, for-profit corrections institutions for the last 12 years, and it's become increasingly obvious that they're, especially detention facilities, are run just in the most horrible way. I've done lots of Freedom of Information Act requests, and I've had the same sorts of difficulties that your reporter has had in getting this information. I've gotten more from whistleblowers or badly redacted documents than I have that the government has been willing to release.
Redacted documents are those blacked out, censored by
That's correct.
The government.
That's right.
As Frank, as you look into this, we were talking about some of these facilities, not all of them, but some of them are indeed run as by private corporations.
Yes. In fact, they're... There's been an enormous expansion because states are cutting back on the use of on the expansion of private prisons, but the federal government has an immigration policy that's caused an enormous expansion. You know, tens of thousands of beds. The problem is with our administration, you know, our White House that's been expanding this and. Hopefully in January we're going to get a new administration.
We're going to get a new administration in January no matter what, Frank. So,
yes.
But let's get to the substance. What percentage of these are run by private corporations, Amy?
Well, it's a real patchwork. There are seven big facilities around the country that are run by private corporations. There are also eight big immigration facilities that are run directly by ICE, the federal agency that oversees immigration. And then there's a network of between 250 and 300 local and county jails. And one of the things we're interested in, which is sort of part of the suggestion that Frank is making, is whether there was, for instance, more likelihood that people would die inside private places or public places. And what we found among the 83 deaths that we found in immigration detention the last 5 years,
since 2003,
that there really wasn't much distinction by kind of facility, that people were dying in all kinds of settings.
And dying, you say, 30 of them, maybe the care or lack of care they got contributed to their deaths.
That's right. I mean, what we did was through a combination of our records, which enabled us to see, in some cases, internal critiques of how a case was handled after somebody died, and some medical records that we share with some outside physicians who know a fair amount about correctional medicine, we tried to figure out how many of the 83 deaths, you know, not necessarily, but at least arguably, might have been caused by the either action or inaction that was taken by the medical staff.
So again, we've got another caller on the line. And this is Erica. Erica is with us from Upland in California. Or she will be if I can hit the right button. Let's see. And let's see if we can go to Erica. There you go. Erica, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I apologize for the problems. Go ahead, please.
That's okay. My fiancé, who is French, was detained at Otay Mesa, a privately run facility by the Corporation Correction of America. And he was given Tylenol for a fever that he had for 2 weeks, only Tylenol. I believe he saw a physician for that. He was actually bleeding in his stool from the food that was given to him. Like, he had trouble passing it, and it made him bleed. Then he complained about the water having been cut off for 5 hours, and there wasn't any toilets, or they were having to go to the bathroom with other people. And they confined him for 21 days in solitary confinement for having complained about that. Also, I met family members while I was waiting. At times, I would have to wait from 5 hours to 7.5 hours to see him in the sun with a 3-month-old baby. And there was no place to nurse her. And they did not treat elderly or sick people with any exception. They were just horrible. They were even worse to the families than they were for the detainees. But I also learned that the female detainees were not necessarily given female hygiene products. Instead, they were given rations of toilet paper, so when they would menstruate, they would sometimes bleed on themselves.
As you learn more about these conditions, Erica, did you complain? Did you try to get some attention? Did you talk to anybody about it?
When he complained for the first time about the water and he was put in solitary confinement, we learned that while he was in the system, it wasn't wise for us to complain. And he's still in the system. He's not being detained there. He's been transferred to a federal facility now. But they reprimand them when they complain.
Dana Priest, is that typical?
Well, we've heard these sorts of complaints before, and particularly about Otay Mesa, which is near the Mexican border outside of San Diego. I was actually up there. And in our story, we chronicle two people who died there, both of which seem to have good cases that their deaths were in some measure due to the fact that the staff were not attentive to their medical needs. In one case, very severely, Francisco Castaneda, who's suing the government, he died this year. But these other issues that you've raised, such as the solitary confinement, they call it the SHU, short stay housing unit. And we've heard repeated complaints from lawyers and some of the detainees we've talked to that this is used to retaliate against people who complain about things that on the surface to us seemed legitimate, like you're mentioning. So we have memos in our story from the clinical director there who's speaking to her peers saying, I can't work these hours any longer. You're asking me to do too much overtime. But in other memos, she's saying, I'm afraid we're going to get sued because we aren't practicing the kind of medicine that they practice on the outside. So there are a lot of issues that pertain to Otay Mesa.
Erica, we wish your husband and you and your child good luck.
Thank you. I would like to just add that I'm just disgusted at the way we treat internationals in this country.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
Very disgusted.
We're
Thank
talking
you.
With Dana Priest and Amy Goldstein of the Washington Post about their series that has been running about the treatment of foreign detainees in immigration detention facilities around the country. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. You describe, you publish memos and descriptions that suggest that the medical care at these facilities was designed to delay, to provide the minimum possible, to do as little as possible, except in utter emergency and in practice, as you also show in your piece, sometimes not even then. Is there any sort of suspicion that, in fact, one of the reasons there is such a policy is they don't want to encourage people to come to the United States, get arrested, and get free medical care?
Well, it's not clear whether that's exactly the motive, but what is clear is that the standard of care that the system sets out to provide people is a little different than what happens on the outside. And the outside, even so the strictest HMO would say, is trying to make people pretty healthy. But in the world of healthcare for immigration detainees, the standard is to make people just healthy enough that they can be deported. And a whole series of decisions flows from that as to what kind of treatment can be provided and what can't. So, for instance, we've seen a manual that specifies what kind of care is allowed, except it's really defined by what kind of care is not allowed. Those are the lists on the pages. You know, what cannot be given for high blood pressure, what cannot be given for various other kinds of illnesses. And that's pretty different than other kinds of health care. In addition, and this is true of managed care generally, but it's particularly clogged in this system, that before most treatment can be provided, nurses or doctors, if there are enough doctors at these various detention facilities, have to get permission in advance to provide care from just four managed care approval people who sit in an office in Washington. And they work from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., Monday to Friday, East Coast time. Well, there are a lot of facilities that are in other time zones. There are a lot of people who get sick over the weekend. So that's just one of the ways in which the treatment decisions get clogged up.
And why you get so much incredible backlogs. Another installment in the series appeared in the Washington Post this morning. How many more to come, Dana Priest?
Well, this is a four-part series, and the fourth came today.
Well, congratulations. So. It's some sobering and astonishing reporting in a series in the Washington Post, and we thank you both for being with us here today, Dana Priest and Amy Goldstein of the Washington Post are with us here at the museum. I'm Neil Conan. Stay tuned for more on the tragedies in Myanmar and China on All Things Considered. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.